Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
There are populist movements everywhere, some on the right, some on the left, but globally we're seeing the people waking up and getting totally disillusioned with their lawmakers and putting new people in power. Not necessarily the best people, but, you know, we're seeing a lot of things. It's a time of shakeup, a time of awareness that we need to change. The young people particularly are driving this. And
that's the voice of Ellen Brown from the Public Banking Institute. On this week's show, we speak to Ellen about how public banking can be a catalyst for social change and environmental justice. So stay tuned.
I'm delighted to be joined this morning by Ellen Brown. She's the author of Web of Debt and her latest book, Banking of the People, Democratizing Money in the Digital Age. Thank you so much for joining us, Ellen.
Oh, thanks, Sylvia. It's always great to talk to you.
Now, let's begin with your book. The idea of democratization, you know, is one that I think we really resonate with in these times of change. Can you talk a little bit about your inspiration for writing this book?
Well, actually, it was an assignment from the Democracy Collaborative, of which I am a senior fellow, and they wanted two papers on how to eliminate too big to fail banks, you know, the problem of banks that were too big to fail, and how to set up a national public banking system. So I agreed to do that. It was supposed to be 50 pages each. And needless to say, it got way longer than anticipated. And it got, you know, more complicated and took me longer. So they agreed that I could turn it into a book, which I did, and they published it, and their editors looked at it, which was great. They had very good editors, so I was pleased about that. But it was a much bigger task than I really intended to take on, but it was good because it forced me to really look at the big picture and figure out all the little details, you know, like, well, if you did this, then you might have this problem. When I write articles, of course, it's just on one little focused area. But when you try to take on the task of setting up a national public banking system, you've got to look at all the ins and outs and ramifications. So it's good.
As we think about, you know, banking, we're also thinking about the economic systems that we live with. You know, in the U.S., as you write, the U.S. federal debt has skyrocketed since 2008. We went from 9.4 trillion in mid-2008 to over 22 trillion in April 2019. Why should we take notice of this? And how is public banking a solution, one of perhaps many solutions to this problem?
The real problem with a skyrocketing federal debt is not really the debt, because we never pay off the debt. The debt really is our money supply. So the government's debt means that money is put into the real economy, which is our money supply, which is good. The real problem with it is the interest. So what I would argue is that first, what we need to do is really nationalize the Federal Reserve. Theoretically, it's a government institution, but it's not. It's actually an independent service composed of 12 branches, all of which are 100% owned by the banks in their districts. And the decisions are made by the Federal Open Market Committee behind closed doors. They're greatly influenced by the big private banks. The largest of the 12 Federal Reserve banks is the New York Fed. And of course, that is where all the big Wall Street banks are. And so they have the most influence on what gets done. And we don't even get to know the basis for their decisions. The decisions just come down, even though all sorts of economists and commentators criticize them. Even the Congress has no leverage over the Fed. They could. Congress set up the Fed, and they could they could change the rules. But the way the rules are right now, the Fed is pretty much in control. And they are not working for us. They are working for the banks. So the first thing we would need to do is have Congress change a few rules so that we could actually have the Federal Reserve have a mandate to serve the public and to serve the economy and to do what's best for the economy and not just bail out banks and do what's best for the banks. You could just have the Federal Reserve print the money, buy up the debt, and rip it up, and we'd be done with the debt. But the Congress doesn't like that. They don't like the idea that this would be inflationary, which I argue it wouldn't. But anyway, they prefer the idea of debt, of thinking that they borrowed the money. So they, if they borrowed it from the central bank, in other words, if the Federal Reserve just bought up all the bonds, which it could do, $22 trillion, it can buy up any amount it wants, as we saw when it did quantitative easing, where it bought $3.7 trillion in government bonds and mortgage-backed securities. And now other central banks all around the world are following suit. In fact, they're more or less out of control. That's why we need to get control again over our central banking system. So if they bought up the debt, the difference would be that they return their profits to the government after deducting their costs. Their costs are an issue, but basically most of the interest would go back to Congress. So it's the interest that's really the problem with the debt, because the interest bill, when the bonds are sold privately, the interest bill has to be paid every year. And that bill is going up and up. And if the Federal Reserve continues its quantitative tightening policies, it will be $1 trillion by 2027, like within less than a decade, which is huge. I mean, that's a huge bite out of our taxes. So we can eliminate that portion of our tax bill by having the Fed buy up the debt.
How does this impact future generations? Because if we don't buy out that debt, if it's not centralized and government, manages it, how will this affect future generations who will then have to pay, you know, the taxes on that?
Yeah, well, that's the point. There's no way we can pay $1 trillion annually to just interest on the debt. That's what we pay. Well, we're already paying that for the military. I mean, we could pay it if we cut down our military budget, but we never seem to get around to doing that. So yes, this would be definitely a burden on future generations. The debt itself is not a burden on future generations. As we've seen, it grows and grows and grows, and still the economy seems to run. Whenever the bonds come due, then the government just buys some more. They just keep rolling them over. So
there are smart people in Wall Street and in the government. So why is this such a difficult barrier to overcome?
The big issue is everybody thinks this would be inflationary, but all of our money, as the Bank of England has now acknowledged, and the Bundesbank and other authorities, the Federal Reserve acknowledged it long ago in an obscure place. I quoted it in Web of Debt, that all of our money, virtually all of our money, is created by banks when they make loans. So they don't borrow the money from their depositors, like most people think. They just write the sum into your account when you take out a loan, and then you can write checks on that account. They do have to come up with money reserves to cover the checks when the money leaves the bank. But anyway, they create the money as loans, and then that increases the money supply. And then when the loan is paid off, that newly created money goes back to zero. And so that's how stability is maintained in the economy. But they always do it at interest. And what they don't do is create the interest. So debt always grows faster than the money supply. And you can look at charts of this and see that this is true not just in the US, but globally right now we have a massive debt problem. So if everyone is in debt, who are they in debt to? They're in debt to the bankers who keep siphoning off this interest that they didn't create in the original loans. So in the old days, like very old, Michael Hudson has written about this, in ancient Sumeria and ancient civilizations, they recognized that problem, that eventually the debt was going to overwhelm the economy and all the farmers were going to wind up debt slaves, and then they couldn't serve in the military, and this was not a good thing for the rulers. So they fixed the problem with periodic debt jubilees, where they would just forgive all the debts. Like every time a new ruler came into power, they would forgive all the debts, and the people in debtor's prison would get to go back to their farms. And that worked. But we can't do that today, because the debt is no longer owed to the emperor or to the king or to Congress. It's owed to private lenders, and they, of course, would mutiny if we tried to just cancel out all their debts, which are their livelihood. So the other alternative is to fill that gap with the gap between the money that's created by banks and the money that's owed back to banks, by putting some new money out there into the money supply, and doing that every year. We need to put excess money into the money supply. And we can do that numerous ways, but one way would be for the government to buy up the debt. The government can also, or sorry, the Federal Reserve to buy up the debt. And the government could also do a universal basic income, which I argue also would not be inflationary. Everybody thinks, well, where are you going to get, whatever, $2 trillion a year? First of all, it wouldn't be $2 trillion that would increase the economy by $2 trillion, because to the extent that it was used to pay down debt, that money would go back to zero. So the money was created as a loan. If you required that, this is universal basic income, if you required that the recipients of this universal basic income use the money to pay down their debts, it's been estimated that 50% of it would go to pay down debts. And so that money would just be extinguished. So now we're down to $1 trillion annually. And it's a lot of that money. Of the rest, the people that didn't have debts, they don't spend their money on consumer goods. They put it in all kinds of, they put it in speculative investments or offshore tax havens or under the mattress or whatever. But a lot of that money, in other words, would not be returned to the consumer economy either. So estimates are that only about a sixth of that $2 trillion would actually increase the money supply, which is something like $333 billion, I guess. And now, we need that money.
One of the things that I love about this idea of a universal income is that it democratizes access to the essentials, access to education, access to housing, access to, you know, just the essentials of life. In Ontario right now, we are faced with the very neoliberalist ideology of budgets, you know, restraining, right, and cutting services. And it's always the social services, it's always the social net that are being, that are often targeted for cuts in the name of paying down the debt, in the name of having balanced budgets. Couldn't we have both? Couldn't we have a society where debt is used to fund projects in the community, and those, as they generate benefits, you know, would cancel out the debt in time?
That's pretty much what I'm arguing as well, that people say, well, we need, the students need help and the homeowners need help. But if you were to, let's say you canceled out, let's say you had the central bank buy up all the student debt, which they could do, and rip it up, then you'd have the people that already paid for their student debt would say, well, nobody paid for my college education, that's not fair. And you'd have the homeowners saying, well, what about me? I suffered in other words, everybody would complain. But a universal basic income, like you say, is very democratic. Everybody gets the same amount, and you can use it for whatever you want. So if you've got big debts, you use it to pay down those debts. Like you say, they always think that we have a limited amount of money, and in order to get the money for the things we need to take it from somewhere else. So we need to take it from social services. That's like, it's usually social services or pay off the infrastructure, you know, sell off the publicly owned infrastructure. We need more money in the system. We can put some extra money in the system. We need another alternative, another way to get money. And the obvious solution is to just print the money, as all governments actually have the right to do. The only reason they don't claim that right is people think it would be inflationary. So that's my big, the big thing that I have to argue away, is to show it wouldn't be inflationary. This is money we need. We are short of money in the money supply, and that's why everybody is in debt.
Now, I also think it's not that they think it will be inflationary. I think that sometimes it's in the bank's best interest not to see that it wouldn't.
Oh, you know, right. Definitely.
So sometimes we don't see what, you know, may seem that in the short term will, you know, limit our privilege to profit from it. So I'm not sure that they don't see what you're sharing with us.
Yeah, no, I agree. That was one advantage of the emperors of, you know, ancient times. They were dictators, and they could just, I mean, fortunately, they were benevolent dictators, or at least they were rational enough to see what their economies needed, and they wanted to have a thriving economy. So they could just say that we're going to do it this way, whereas now we always have to argue, and you always get pushback. There's always some argument that looks good on its face that blocks legislators from doing the thing. They're so resistant to change.
I also think that there are many structures in society that, you know, script how we see the world. In our education, in our cultural milieus, in the ways that we're socialized to see the world, we've accepted by force, this was not easily accepted at first, but by force people have become adapting to a neoliberalism way of seeing the world, where everything needs to be privatized, all the profits are privatized, and all the costs get socialized. So the government continues to borrow money at great interest, which means we are giving the banks the ability to privatize, you know, the profits of borrowing that money. And we're all paying, we're socializing the cost of it, you know, paying the interest, paying for the security that is required to maintain that kind of inequality in our society. So we wouldn't need a large military if we didn't have such an equal social gap between people who have and people who can, you know, don't have even the bare essentials. So let's talk a little bit about how do we begin to shift this. I believe that we shift a powerful narrative such as that of privatization, or that the banks have to be the only ones that can produce money, by creating good examples. Can you share with us some of the examples of good banking, public banking systems that have already demonstrated the way forward?
Well, in the U.S., we had, of course, we had the American colonists to start with, who just issued their own money and had a thriving economy, which totally surprised the Europeans, because here were people in the wilderness that weren't supposed to have anything, and they just had this burgeoning economy. And in fact, apparently Benjamin Franklin made the mistake of going to England when the king said they could no longer print their own money, or limited certain states or colonies from printing their own money. And he went to England and he made the argument that, no, this is why we're doing so well, you know, that we're printing our own money and we don't need to borrow. We don't need to borrow from the Bank of England. And of course, the Bank of England was not pleased with that. And so the upshot was that all the colonies then were not allowed to issue their own money. And then we have Abraham Lincoln, who did the same thing, returned to the system where the government just issued the money. So he was trying to avoid a huge, like 30% interest bill to British bankers in order to fund the Civil War. To avoid that, he just issued the money directly and actually literally doubled the money supply. And there was some inflation then, but it was only inflation relative to gold. And it was no more inflationary than World War One, et cetera. I mean, it's typical that in a war you have inflation because you have shortages. And meanwhile, over the next 20 years, they built the Transcontinental Railroad, which joined both ends of the country and turned a profit on that. I mean, they had did some remarkable things with this extra money that was put into the economy. And then there was Roosevelt, who had the problem of the banks were literally bankrupt in the 1930s, and nobody seemed to have any money. So, or the banks didn't have money anyway. There was no credit available. So he created his own credit machine with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which had been set up by the previous President Hoover. And Roosevelt greatly expanded it. What they did was they made loans to any sort of productive venture, like anything that would pay back, like railroads and dams and farmers and bridges. And so over the course of 25 years that the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was in business, and of course it was a public lending institution, so a public bank basically, although it wasn't called a bank, they rebuilt the country, funded the U.S.'s participation in World War II, and turned a profit for the government. So it didn't cost the government money. It actually made money for the government. So it seems to me that, I mean, those are just U.S. examples, and there are a lot of foreign examples that I could go into.
And the examples you present are, exactly the kind of memory we need to recall, because all of these stories of amazing successes that were created by simply having a centralized banking, having your own independence to create the kinds of social networks you need. Imagine if the money was being borrowed and used to build housing, to build hospitals, to build bridges, and the income that comes from those institutions, from having, you know, universities publicly funded. I think that the return we get is exponential, and we can't even begin to imagine what kinds of amazing changes would occur if we just simply shifted this idea that, you know, it is only the banks that could produce the money, and the bank and the government has to borrow. One of the things that I love about you is how you demystified this relationship of debt and production, this relationship with debt and inflation. Can we talk a little bit about how have we gone to this point where debt has become this very scary, nebulous place we dare not go, and where austerity and, you know, cutting has become the norm?
Well, I think it is what you point out, that the government, first of all, is not allowed to run a business, basically. The government is not allowed to make money. And one way it could make money and should make money is by running its own banking system. But anything that's profitable is supposed to go to the private sector. How did we come by that notion? It was because big money managed to buy off Congress. And the politicians need money in order to run. They take the money from the big donors, and then they do what the big donors want. And the big lobbyists get in there, and they pretty much write the laws, and Congress passes them. I had to go up to Sacramento we had a bill for a public banking. It was a public banking bill to turn the California Infrastructure and Development Bank into a public depository bank. And so I saw the sausage factory of how legislation was made. It was really quite alarming. But it's clear that it's lobbyists working behind the scenes that actually determine what laws are passed and what aren't. And big money are the only ones that can afford these big lobbyists. So they always win. So they make the laws that favor themselves and that don't favor us. And they hire the economists who have those theories that favor them and don't favor us. So somehow we have to democratize the whole thing. But it seems to me right now we have a big push for there are populist movements everywhere, some on the right, some on the left, but globally we're seeing the people waking up and getting totally disillusioned with their lawmakers and putting new people in power, not necessarily the best people, but you know, we're seeing a lot of things. It's a time of shakeup, a time of awareness that we need to change. The young people particularly are driving this, and they are the ones that they've come into the world with a raw deal, and they see that they've got to have change and they've got to have it now. There's the whole climate problem where the whole, you know, we're losing our species at an amazing rate. And anyway, things have come to a sort of desperate state. And so hopefully if we can mobilize a large enough percentage of the population, maybe arguably we can actually get some political change going.
I feel that we are not only at a turning point, I see that we are taking ownership of our own responsibility. Because I think what the most successful story or script that we have been socialized to believe is that we have no power to change it. And that, I think, is exactly where we are. We are at the point where we're no longer willing to sit with this story, and we're willing to create a new script, you know, one in which we are rewriting. How would you like to invite your students or the people who read your book to engage with your work, with the book that you're offering us?
Well, I'm chairman of the Public Banking Institute, and we do what we can to implement public banks all over. So you could go to our website at publicbankinginstitute.org for more information. And then my books are, or I have a blog where I've got, oh, I should count them out. I might be up to 400 by now. But anyway, I have over 300 articles on my blog that are mostly all on this subject at ellenbrown.com. And then I have 3 books on this subject and 13 books altogether, but 3 on this subject. Anyway, to me, my own mission or what I try to do is, you know, just to spread this information, because I think the first thing you need to know is what's really going on. When you get it, what the problem is, then you can see what we can do to fix it. So we have all these little movements going on, but they're kind of in silos, like you say. There's certain ones for social justice and certain ones for public banking and for the worrying about the environment, etc. If we could get all those movements together, if we could form a true people's party that actually saw that if we could take back the power, including taking back the money power, that we can actually change things. Like you say, most people, they think, well, what can I do about it? So they don't want to think about it. It's too depressing, and they think they have no power. But we actually do have power if we get together. First of all, if we figure out what's going on, and then second of all, mobilize, join groups, and, you know, consolidate.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us today. Tell our audience your website again.
My website's ellenbrown.com, and the Public Banking Institute is publicbankinginstitute.org.
Thank you again for being with us, Ellen.
Thank you, Sylvia. Always great to talk to you.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.